This is Lecture 2 in the series Capital, the Productive Process, and the Rate of Profit.
Well, once again, good morning. I'd like to begin just by quoting a few lines from that second paragraph from John Stuart Mill, which I think is particularly appropriate. He says, on page 5 of my supplement, "This theorem that to purchase produce is not to employ labor, that the demand for labor is constituted by the wages which precede the production and not by the demand which may exist for the commodities resulting from the production, is a proposition which greatly needs all the illustration it can receive. It is, to common apprehension, a paradox. And even among political economists of reputation, I can hardly point to any except Mr. Ricardo and Monsieur Say, who have kept it constantly and steadily in view. Almost all others occasionally express themselves as if a person who buys commodities, the produce of labor, was an employer of labor and created a demand for it as really and in the same sense as if he had bought the labor itself directly by the payment of wages. It is no wonder that political economy advances slowly when such a question as this still remains open at its very threshold." Well, Mill's observation made 140 years or so ago is still appropriate today. Regrettably, I think it applies to many people here. Some of you have no trouble grasping the fact that you only buy what you buy. Others think that somehow when you buy something, you're buying more than you buy it. In the interest of giving this proposition, which I call the demand for A is the demand for A, not simply demand for commodities is not demand for labor, to give this a further illustration, I'd like you all to imagine that this class represents the entire economic system. We lock the doors, and for a few minutes, we're on our own. We represent the economy of the world. The people back in the last row are growing wheat. And they have just harvested their wheat, and they have sold that wheat to the people in the row in front of them. And they've sold that wheat for $3,000. And even as I'm talking, the people in the row in front of them are busy processing that wheat into flour. And as I'm getting ready to finish this sentence, they have completed the processing of flour, and they sell it to the people in the third row from the rear for $5,000. And those people are speedily converting that flour into bread, which they sell to the people in the row in front of them for $6,000. Now, I have two very simple questions to ask you all. What is the total gross physical product that has just been produced? What is the total gross product that has been produced? Pardon me? The wheat, the flour, and the bread. Can anyone say that this has not been produced and this has not been produced? We've just said the people in the last row have produced the wheat, and the people in front of them have produced the flour, and the people in the front of them have produced the bread. Wheat has been produced, flour has been produced, bread has been produced. That is the gross product. Now, the wheat has been consumed in making the flour, but that does not obliterate the fact of its production. The flour is consumed in making the bread, but that does not obliterate the fact that it was produced. The total gross product that was produced was the wheat, the flour, and the bread. And what was the sales value of the gross product? $14,000. That is the amount of money that was spent to buy the gross product. Now, we might imagine a situation in which temporarily only the bread is produced. Let's assume we're fortunate enough, we begin with a pre-existing inventory of flour. And now, for a time, bread is being produced. Well, what happens to the flour? It's used up, and then what must happen to the production of the bread? It must stop. Now, a simple point to realize is the production of bread does not constitute the production of flour. The production of bread presupposes the production of flour, but does not constitute the production of flour. The eating of bread presupposes the production of bread, but does not constitute the production of bread. You know, there are people who think you can have your cake and eat it too. There are worse than those. There are people who believe when you eat your bread, you're baking it. The fact is that everything that is produced, and we are not entitled to obliterate its existence through any conceptual knowledge that we may possess. Now, I hope that that will help. I want to say the main point of yesterday's lecture was to establish the need for recognizing the full parity of existence of capital goods. Capital goods do not become obliterated because they're used up in further production. Their production is real and must be recognized fully as much as the production of consumer goods. The spending to buy capital goods, the spending to pay wages, is real and must be recognized, not just the spending to buy consumers' goods. Now, that recognition is a question which, for this audience, I now will consider as closed, and that being settled, we can proceed to start making some substantial advances, as Mill would put it, in the field of political economy. We're not going to be confused by this debris of confusion of thinking that one thing is another and that we see everything when we see a part. Where I want to take you and hope to start arriving there Saturday and certainly next Monday is to a conceptual framework that will enable you to grasp many of the essentials of the entire economic system on a single page. I'd like to provide you with the means of performing your own economic analyses, to give you, in effect, a kind of intellectual laboratory into which you can bring parts of economic reality and analyze them from different perspectives, push and poke them, prod them, turn them around, and see what connections they have with other things. And what we've done here in establishing what is in fact produced, what is in fact bought, that is an essential first step. Now, a further step, a major connecting link, represents material that many of you are already familiar with if you attended the TJS seminar in the fall of 88. I gave a lecture, Everyone's Stake in Capitalism 2, which is sold by Second Renaissance Book Service under a slightly different title. Now, in this lecture, I established what causes capital accumulation. The context was, what determines real wages? Now, it will be necessary for me to give you a rather extensive review of that material. We'll get beyond it today, hopefully, but that is an essential building block of a wider conceptual construction, a conceptual framework, in terms of which I think you can see major aspects of the entire economic world. All right, I'll try to follow pretty much the procedure I followed in that previous lecture, Everyone's Stake in Capitalism 2. In the supplement This is presented on pages 7 through 9, and I hope to get somewhat beyond that. And I want to start off explaining this proposition that capital accumulation and real wages depend on the relative production of capital goods and the productivity of capital goods. I'll hopefully make these terms clear to you if you're not already familiar with them very shortly. Real wages are the goods and services a worker can buy with the money he earns. The goods and services a worker can buy with the money he earns. They depend on the relationship between the money he earns and the prices he pays. If you make $10,000 a year and the price of coffee is $2 a pound and a pair of shoes is $40 a pair and on, that represents a state of purchasing power. It represents what you can buy with the money you earn. At a later point in time, you might earn 10 times that money. You might earn $1 million, but it doesn't mean that you'll be able to buy any more actual goods. That will depend on what's happened to the prices of the goods you have to pay. Well, real wages are determined by the relationship between the wages you earn and the prices you have to pay. And what determines that relationship is the productivity of labor, how much the average worker can produce per period of time. The more the average worker can produce per period of time, the lower will prices be relative to wages. You may recall I mentioned the need for analyzing things under the assumption of an invariable money. Well, let's imagine we had a constant quantity of money, a fixed volume of money, and total payrolls in the economy were fixed, and the average annual wage per worker was $10,000 a year. We had so many billions of payrolls, there were so many millions of workers. These things are constant. The average annual wage is $10,000 a year. And there's so much total spending to buy the output of consumers' goods. We have a definite expenditure to buy consumers' goods. Well, what will happen if people become able to produce more, if the same number of workers are enabled to produce more? Well, they'll still make the same money on average, but there'll be a larger quantity of goods selling for the same total expenditure of money. So what will happen to the prices of those goods? They'll go down. And what happens to the wages of those workers in buying power? Goes up. Well, that's actually the way that real wages rise all the time. The only thing that enables us all to earn more money at the same time is the existence of a larger quantity of money. But the underlying force raising real wages is the rise in the productivity of labor. Now, what is it that is responsible for the rise in the productivity of labor? The essential answer is the increase in the supply of capital goods per worker. If the average worker can work with more and better equipment, higher quality materials and components and so forth, then he will be able to produce more. We can have people performing the same physical effort. If they're digging at the ground with their fingers and nails, they achieve very little. If they can use shovels, they accomplish something more. If they can use bulldozers and steam shovels, still more. It's pretty obvious that the productivity of labor vitally depends on the quantity and quality of capital goods. Well, the question is, how does capital accumulation come about? How can we achieve more capital goods per worker? And there are two basic components to the answer. The supply of capital goods, the growth in the supply of capital goods, depends in part on the relative production of capital goods, the extent to which we devote our efforts to producing capital goods, and also on the productivity of capital goods, on how much output we can obtain per unit of whatever capital goods we have. Now, I want to try to illustrate these ideas quantitatively. And on pages 8 and 9, You have two diagrams which may look a little intimidating. They're not, and you'll see that they're not when we explain them. Now, what I'm assuming here is that we start out from the past, we've inherited some definite quantity of capital goods, to which I give the name 1K. It's important to work with ideas of definite quantities in order to see any possible quantitative relationships that may exist. We start out, we have 1K of capital goods in year one on page 8. And these 1K of capital goods, when employed by 1L of labor, whatever the number of workers there are, working whatever time they work per week, 1K of capital goods plus 1L of labor have some definite total productive potential. And they're capable of producing consumer goods or, alternatively, capital goods. Think of the fact the factories of General Motors can produce passenger automobiles, which for the most part are consumer goods, or they can produce trucks and diesel locomotives, which for the most part are capital goods. The construction industry can produce residential housing, which for the most part represents consumer goods, or it can produce factory and office buildings, which represent capital goods. The appliance industry can produce consumer appliances, or it can produce equipment for business. There are wide alternatives. Labor can be employed in producing capital goods or consumer goods. Whether or not an economy increases its capital goods will depend in large measure on what proportion of the labor available and the existing capital goods are used to produce capital goods rather than consumer goods. Now notice, whatever capital goods already exist don't stay in existence. They are constantly being used up or worn out. Wheat and flour are physically used up in one stroke to make their products. Machinery and buildings wear out over time. All capital goods are continuously being used up or worn out. And in order to maintain the supply of capital goods intact, you have to reproduce them. Capital goods require continuous production merely to keep the supply intact. If we didn't produce capital goods, we would use up whatever we had. Now, to make this analysis as simple as possible, I'm going to assume that whatever capital goods exist at the start of a year are entirely used up in that year. That's a simplifying assumption. In reality, many machines and buildings will last for decades or generations. But I'm going to assume that everything is used up in the current year, and that everything, therefore, needs to be reproduced in that current year if the supply of capital goods is to remain intact. So I'm assuming we start out, we've got 1K of capital goods. In the course of production, this 1K of capital goods will be used up in producing either capital goods or consumer goods. One way or another, it's going to be used up. Now, to keep things relatively simple, I'm also going to assume that the potential of the capital goods and labor that we have, if we devoted the capital goods and labor 100% to the production of consumer goods, we could produce a quantity of consumer goods that I'll call 2C. But at that time, we could produce no capital goods. We could produce, in other words, at one extreme, zero of capital goods and two of consumer goods. That would be one extreme. At the other extreme, we could produce two of capital goods and zero of consumer goods. If we devoted 100% of our effort to capital goods, we'd produce 2K and no consumer goods. if we devoted 100% of our efforts to consumer goods, we'd produce no capital goods and 2 units of consumer goods. And a unit, of course, stands for an awful lot. It's a giga unit, if you're into computers. All right, now, there's an implicit proportion of output required to replace the capital goods that are being used up. We're using up 1K, no matter what we produce. If we devoted 100% of our effort to producing capital goods, we'd produce 2K. Well, what's the implied proportion needed merely to maintain the production of capital goods? 50%. I call 50% in this case the maintenance proportion. The maintenance proportion is that portion of the output that needs to be in the form of capital goods merely to replace the capital goods being used up. The maintenance proportion is that portion of output which needs to be in the form of capital goods in order to replace the capital goods being used up. Well, what does this imply about what needs to happen if we're to accumulate capital rather than merely maintain it? Yes? We have to devote more than 50% of our existing ability to produce to capital goods. If we devote only 50%, we have a stationary economic system. And that kind of economic system is depicted in Figure 1. Notice, in each year, we have 50% of the existing ability to produce devoted to capital goods and 50% devoted to consumer goods. In year 2, a fresh 1L of labor is applied to that fresh 1K of capital goods. The labor and capital goods in year 2 are devoted 50-50 to producing capital goods and consumer goods. We again replace the capital goods. In year 3, the same story repeats itself. And then I draw a series of dots, and this goes on and on to year N. So we have a stationary economic system. If we're to have a progressing economic system, an essential is that a proportion of the existing labor and capital goods has to be devoted to producing capital goods that is greater than the maintenance proportion. In this example, something greater than 50%. Now, what's going to determine the relative production of capital goods versus the relative production of consumer goods? What's going to determine if it's 50-50 and we merely replace the capital goods used up, or if we will devote more than 50% to capital goods? It will be saving, but even before it's saving, it is the relative demand for capital goods and consumer goods. See, what determines the extent to which General Motors devotes its plants to producing Chevrolets rather than Pontiacs? The demand. If the demand for Chevrolets went up and Pontiacs went down, they'd shift their production accordingly. Well, if the demand for trucks and diesel locomotives and so forth went up relative to the demand for passenger automobiles, they'd gear up in that way, and they'd shift their effort. If the proportion of construction, which was in the form of factory buildings and office buildings, if the demand for that rose relative to the demand for residential housing, then the construction industry would change its line of effort accordingly. Those industries which produce capital goods exclusively would become larger relative to those which produce consumer goods exclusively if the demand for capital goods rose relative to the demand for consumer goods. In the same way, if the demand for automobiles in total, if the demand for motor vehicles in total rose relative to the demand for housing, the auto industry would grow relative to the housing industry. If the demand for capital goods grows relative to the demand for consumer goods, those industries devoted exclusively to capital goods grow relative to those devoted exclusively to consumer goods. the divisions and departments of firms that do both, well, their capital goods divisions grow relative to their consumer goods divisions. So the extent to which the economy concentrates on producing capital goods relative to consumer goods depends on the relative demands. And where does the demand for capital goods come from? It comes with funds that people don't consume. If people were to consume the funds, there'd be a greater demand for consumer goods, a lesser demand for capital goods. To the extent that funds are not consumed, to the extent they're saved and then used to purchase capital goods, then we have a greater demand for capital goods relative to consumer goods. You could imagine examples of the following kind. Suppose we have some wealthy individuals who are earning high incomes. They have the choice, should they buy a luxury automobile or perhaps a yacht or whatever, or forego that and keep that money in their businesses, and instead that money might contribute to purchasing a truck or an ocean-going steamer or whatever. Now, depending on what they do with that money, and assuming this prevails across the economy, that's going to affect what's produced. The extent to which people consume influences the relative production of consumer goods. If they cut back on what they're consuming and devote that instead to buying capital goods, then we encourage the production of capital goods. So the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumer goods depends on the degree of saving. Now, there's another major aspect in capital accumulation. Saving and the relative production of capital goods are essential. Their importance cannot be overstated. But there is another major aspect which has been ignored since the time of David Ricardo. And this is the fact that the ability to accumulate capital goods depends also on the productivity of capital goods. How much output can we obtain from whatever capital goods we already have? Now, here we are. Let's say we can produce 2K of capital goods or 2C of consumer goods. We need to produce 50% capital goods just to stand pat. Suppose we became more efficient, and instead of being able to produce just 2K or 2C as the outer limits and intermediate combinations, suppose we became more efficient, and let's imagine we could produce at one extreme 3K and 0C, or 3C and 0K. How would that affect the proportion of output needed for replacement? Wouldn't it reduce the maintenance proportion? It would make it one-third. If we could produce 3 units of output for each existing 1 unit of capital goods, then to replace the capital goods, we only need one-third. And what would happen to our ability to accumulate capital goods if we continued to devote 50% while all we needed for maintenance was one-third? We would accumulate capital goods. We'd have substantial capital accumulation. Well, capital accumulation depends on the relative production of capital goods and the productivity of capital goods. How much output can we get per unit of capital goods that we have? Now, we'll come back to the productivity aspect in a moment or two. I'd like to call your attention to Figure 2, the relative production of capital goods in a progressing economy. Here, we're going to trace out what happens if the relative demand for capital goods goes up, if it becomes 600 rather than 500. And excuse me, I have to back up a bit. We've talked about relative demand. I didn't put in numbers yet, and now I'm jumping ahead of myself. What will determine a 50-50 relative demand in Figure 1, the stationary economy, is if, for example, there were 500 units of money spent each year to buy capital goods and 500 units of money spent each year to buy consumer goods. If there's 500 of demand for each, that will determine a relative production of each of 50-50. The total demand is 1,000. If it's broken down 50-50, well, that gives us a relative demand of 50-50. And we'll have a relative production of 50-50. That gives us a stationary economy. Well, now what happens if people decide, instead of consuming 500 and making only 500 available for the purchase of capital goods, they'll cut their consumption back to 400 and make 600 available for the purchase of capital goods. Well, now the relative demand for capital goods becomes 60% to 40%. What will happen to the relative production of capital goods and consumer goods? You can see it if you look at figure 2. Now we'll concentrate 60% on producing capital goods and only 40% on producing consumer goods. Well, how much capital goods can we produce with 60% of our effort if 100% would produce 2K? Well, they'll grow by a ratio of 6 to 5, I think. Capital goods will now be 1.2. We'll have an output of capital goods of 1.2 and an output of consumer goods of 0.8C. That's for year 2. We've temporarily produced less consumer goods in order to produce more capital goods. We've cut back on the production of some luxury automobiles, mansions, yachts, so forth. Or, more realistically, we've cut back on the consumption of the government, people spending welfare payments and so forth, and instead we're producing capital goods. All right, now here we are at the start of year 2 in figure 2. We now have 1.2K of capital goods rather than 1K. What does this do to our ability to produce? It increases it. Now, I'm going to make the assumption, and later defend it, that the ability to produce can be proportionate to the supply of capital goods. So that if now we have 1.2K instead of only 1K, I'm going to assume our total overall productive ability increases 20%. Now, if we devoted 100% of our effort to producing capital goods, instead of producing just 2, we could produce 2.4. If we devoted 100% of our effort to consumer goods, we could produce 2.4 of those. Well, how much can we produce if we continue with the 60-40 relative production? What is 60% of 2.4? I supply you with the answer, 1.44K, and 40% of 2.4 is 0.96. All right, that's the output of capital goods and consumer goods for year 3. Now, in year 3, 1 L of labor picks up 1.44K of capital goods, and total productive ability is now increased a further 20%. So in year 4, output is going to be 1.728K of capital goods and 1.152C of consumer goods. The production of both is growing. Now, those of you who've studied economics, you might think that the assumption I've made contradicts a principle you were taught as freshmen. Here we are. We have a growing supply of capital goods. We have the same supply of labor. We have 1 L of labor in each year, yet there's 20% more capital goods, and I'm telling you the output is proportional to the capital goods. All right, what principle of economics does that seem to contradict? The law of diminishing returns. The law of diminishing returns. The law of diminishing returns says that if we keep one factor of production constant, like labor, and merely increase another, like capital goods, we'll get more output, but it will be in diminishing proportion. Well, under what assumption does the law of diminishing returns make under which it's valid? What is taken as given? Yes? The state of technology is taken as a given. Now, if we had a frozen state of technology, then the additional supply of capital goods would encounter diminishing returns. But if we have technological progress, the growing supply of capital goods need not encounter diminishing returns. If we have a combination of technological progress and a sufficiently high relative production of capital goods, then we can have a continuing increase in the supply both of capital goods and consumer goods. Every time we get more capital goods, we'll be able to produce not only more consumer goods, but also more capital goods, and be able to do so in the same proportion if we have technological progress. Now notice, a major implication here is that a fundamental element in capital accumulation is not only the relative production of capital goods and saving, which is absolutely vital, but technological progress plays an enormous role in capital accumulation. And more than that, anything which increases our ability to produce in general, if with whatever labor and capital goods we have, we could produce more, if we could produce 3K, 3C, instead of 2 and 2, or 2 or 2, for whatever reason, whether it's technological progress or anything, how would that affect capital accumulation? It impacts our ability to have capital accumulation favorably. All right, what sorts of things determine the general efficiency of the economic system and therefore determine capital accumulation? The general state of economic freedom. Such a thing as free international trade, freedom of immigration, freedom from antitrust laws, freedom from labor union interference. Think of anything which undercuts economic efficiency in general, and it will also undercut the ability of existing labor and capital goods to produce capital goods. It's not the case that when we impair efficiency, all we're doing is slowing down the ability to produce consumer goods. We're also undercutting our ability to produce capital goods. Now, you could never begin to see this if you didn't grant full parity of recognition to capital goods. If one thinks that all that's being produced are consumer goods, and the only way we accumulate capital goods is through saving, you'll never get to the point of recognizing that such a thing as technological progress is a major source of capital accumulation, that economic freedom is a source of capital accumulation. Now, David Ricardo is the only economist, maybe James Mill also. They recognized that capital can be accumulated by anything which increases wealth. Anything that increases wealth can increase capital, not just saving, the general efficiency of the economy. Fully developed, this means free trade, even free immigration. Now, I made some applications in the fall, which I think bear repeating. Apply this, for example, to Soviet Russia. Since 1917 or 1918, the Russians have claimed they've been unable to raise the standard of living because they're concentrating on heavy industry. Now that could apply for a few years. That you could say, all right, till 1925. But now they should have some big heavy industry, and what should that do to their total overall ability to produce, even if they're devoting a modest proportion to consumer goods? It should be going up. If it doesn't go up, and the explanation is still that they're building heavy industry, they would have had to increase the proportion. And that would mean they'd need a constantly rising relative production of capital goods, where long since they'd have had 99 44/100% production of capital goods, and they should be one huge factory from Leningrad to Vladivostok. But they're not, And when they want to construct something, they have to call in foreign countries, even Italy. Now, there's a reason for this, which we can now connect. They're incredibly inefficient. They're supposedly masters at the construction of brand new old buildings. They have hydroelectric stations built, but no generators. They have tractors, but no spare parts, or the gasoline that they have corrodes the engines. And this is a chronic problem. They have constant shortages and chaos, as I describe in The Government Against the Economy. So what would you expect about the level of output that they could obtain from any existing level of capital goods? It would be very little. And in the absence of an outside world, they'd be so inefficient, they could not replace whatever capital goods they started with. Inefficiency undercuts capital accumulation. All right, this becomes clear when you recognize that capital goods are regular goods and have to be treated just as consumer goods. They're as real, they're subject to all the same principles of production as consumer goods. Now, let me point out, as I did in the fall, that what would transform the United States from its present state of being virtually a stationary economy into once again being a progressing economy would be a radical reduction in government spending and government regulation. The more, the better, obviously. If we slashed government spending and taxes of the kind that fall on saving, above all taxes on business profits, inheritances, interest, capital gains, the incomes that are most heavily saved, we would shift to a much higher relative production of capital goods. At the same time, we'd sharply increase the incentives to production, which would boost the efficiency with which capital goods are employed. If we abolished the antitrust laws, or even to the extent that we limit their application, if we allow efficient mergers to proceed, that means you get more output per unit of input. If you have two firms, each of which, if they are using a machine, can only use it 40%, but if they merge, they could use it efficiently. Well, that's contributing to the general efficiency of production. If you eliminate the legislation that supports labor union interference and they're preventing the employment of more effective machinery and more efficient work methods, you again raise the output per unit of input. The solution to achieving a progressing economy is minimize government spending, taxation, and regulation. And ultimately, of course, abolish the regulation altogether. And, well, you know where I stand on these issues. All right. This is, as far as we need to go, with a recapitulation of the material I presented last fall. I just want to stress this point that I state on page 10 concerning the theoretical significance of giving parity of recognition to the production of capital goods, that, again, this is what makes it possible to see the importance of the question of economic efficiency. I'll give you one further illustration along these lines. In contemporary economic analysis, even the best of it, for example, there is a fear of free immigration. Now, it's assumed that if we have free immigration, we have more labor, but there's no necessary connection to the supply of capital goods. And we'll have then a reduced ratio of capital goods to labor as a result of free immigration. Now, the implication of my analysis is that that is not true. If we have a free economy, if we had a capitalist economy, and we had free immigration from unfree economies, well, think what happens to people who are born and have to pass their lives in an economy where there is severe limitation of freedom. What is the effect on their potential for development? They can't. Now, suppose those people and their children and grandchildren could live under economic freedom, they would have the potential for development. What would be the effect of that on the general efficiency with which we use labor and capital goods? It would increase. So over time, we would end up with more capital accumulation rather than less. Also, let me stress, or I'll save that for later. I think that's enough on the importance of granting parity of recognition to capital goods for the time being. Now also, an important theoretical implication is when we add in the assumption of an invariable money, fixed total spending, is it necessary, in order to have capital accumulation, that the demand for capital goods continue to rise? If you look at figure 2, what is the demand for capital goods in each year, and what's happening to the supply of capital goods? We have the same demand for capital goods, the same demand for consumer goods, and yet we have capital accumulation. Is it necessary for the amount of the total 1,000 of revenue that is not consumed, that's saved and spent for capital goods, is it necessary for that to go on rising? No, it isn't. It's necessary that it be sufficiently high, but not that it go on rising. Now, if it did rise, what would be the effect? Imagine the relative demand for capital goods, it went to 700 and the demand for consumer goods to 300. Then we would have an acceleration of capital accumulation. Now, the actual relationship of saving to capital accumulation, which becomes clear when you analyze things under an invariable money, the actual relationship is as force to acceleration. Most economists think that in order to have capital accumulation, you need a one-to-one act of saving, that for each act of capital accumulation, we need a new act of saving. But if we analyze things in terms of an invariable money, then we see that the real significance of saving is the extent to which it determines the relative demand for capital goods. If we have a sufficiently high relative demand, we can have a sufficiently high stable relative demand and have capital accumulation. A yet higher relative demand would mean an acceleration of capital accumulation. I consider this analogous to the recognition in physics that to put an object in motion, we apply force, but then the basic assumption of modern physics is that the object then stays in motion with the same velocity. And if we apply more force, the velocity is increased. Well, we have the same basic idea in economics if we analyze things in terms of an invariable money. All right, now let me try to break some new ground here. Figures 1 and 2 contain some implicit additional information. If we know how to look for it, we can identify what is national income in Figure 1 and in Figure 2. National income is present implicitly in Figures 1 and 2. Now, let me tell you, for those of you who aren't, who have never taken an economics course, and national income is not something that I think of as any kind of glorious concept. I'm setting this up for purposes of criticism, actually. National income is the sum, basically, of profits and wages, or profits, wages, and interest. It's the sum of the different types of income, basically profits, wages, and interest, earned in production and exchange. Now, what we have here, we have in Figure 1, We have 500 of demand for consumer goods, and we have 500 of demand for capital goods, and this goes on year after year after year. And we also have the capital goods of each preceding year being used up in producing the output of the current year. For example, if you look at year two in figure one, we have 1K of capital goods produced in response to a demand for capital goods of 500. Now, what physically happens to those capital goods that are purchased for 500? What will be done with them? They're used up to produce the output of year three. They're all used up. Well, this 500 that's spent to buy capital goods in year two will represent the cost on account of capital goods of producing the output of year three. Notice, how much does the output of year three sell for in total? 1,000. The output of year three is 1K of capital goods, which is sold for 500. It's 1C of consumer goods, which is sold for 500. And what was the cost of the capital goods bought in year two and used in production in year two? What was the cost of those capital goods to produce the output of year three? 500. Well, we have a total of 1,000 of sales revenues in year three, and then in year four and every other year. We have 1,000 of sales revenues. Can my handwriting be read in the back? Yeah, all right. And we have 500 cost on account of capital goods, which I'll abbreviate. Now, if we subtract the 500 cost on account of capital goods from 1,000 of sales revenues, that difference is national income. Now, let me explain why. I give you the explanation on the bottom of page 11. If instead of taking away sales on account of capital goods, if instead of taking away costs on account of capital goods, we subtracted all costs from sales revenues. If we simply subtract costs from sales revenues, what do we have? What's sales revenues minus costs? Profits. Now, if we're subtracting merely the costs on account of capital goods, that is subtracting all the costs but wages and interest. There are the costs on account of capital goods, and there are the labor and interest costs. We'll ignore taxes. All right, now, when we subtract costs but, that's subtracting total costs minus. To subtract costs on account of capital goods is the equivalent of subtracting total costs minus the cost on account of wages and interest. Cost on account of capital goods is total costs minus the costs on account of wages and interest. So now, when we subtract costs on account of capital goods from sales revenues, that is subtracting costs minus wages and interest. Well, what do we get if we have sales revenues minus, parenthesis, costs minus wages minus interest? Profits. We have profits plus wages plus interest. If we subtract from sales revenues costs minus wages and interest, the result is profit plus wages and interest. And that is national income. Subtracting costs on account of capital goods alone, i.e., total cost minus wages minus interest, that's profit plus wages plus interest, that's national income. So is it clear why national income is equal to sales revenues minus the cost on account of capital goods? Okay, so can we have that down pat? Yeah? Oh, don't jump to the table yet. All right. Now, if that's national income, then I want you to answer the question, where is national income higher? In figure one, which is a stationary economy, or figure two, which is a progressing economy? If you look at it in front of you, national income is higher in figure one. National income, under the assumption of an invariable money, namely a fixed total spending for goods, consumer goods and capital goods together, national income is higher in the stationary economy than in the progressing economy. Can there be any doubt about this? If we've been correct up to now, if we have sales revenues, we have costs on account of capital goods, national income is lower in the progressing economy. Now we can see that. That is almost perceptually evident, as close as we can get to the perceptual level. Now we have to explain it. Why is it that national income is lower in figure two than in figure one? There's more spending for capital goods. Now you see, the spending for capital goods is part of sales revenues. Total sales revenues are the same. Sales revenues are 1,000 in figure one and figure two. In figure two, there is a larger spending for capital goods. Well, what does that do to the total costs on account of capital goods that we have to deduct from sales revenues? It brings it up. Greater spending for capital goods, which on the one side brings about a greater relative production of capital goods, a continuing increase in the physical ability to produce, also results in a larger deduction of capital goods cost from sales revenues. So national income falls. Well, what is the wider implication that we can draw from this? Well, I think we could say, go beyond that and say that under the conditions of an economy with an invariable money, national income and economic progress and prosperity are inversely related. under the conditions of an economy with an invariable money, a fixed volume of spending for goods of all kinds, capital goods and consumer goods together, national income and economic progress and prosperity are inversely related. Is this urgent to... I was looking at Jack Crawford. This is everybody's definition of national income. It's the sum of profits, wages, and interest, and they also add in a minor term, rent. We have many economics majors here. Am I mistaken in the definition of national income? No. This is the definition of national income, the sum of profits, wages, and interest income. And a greater relative demand for capital goods operates to reduce national income. So I want you to be aware that there is an inverse relationship between in an economy with an invariable money, there's an inverse relationship between national income and economic progress and prosperity. Now, let me go a little bit further and elaborate this. If we had of economic progress instead of stagnation, and now we drop the assumption of an invariable money, let's substitute now the assumption of a gold standard. Let's imagine that every unit of money is a physical unit of gold. And now we have a greater relative production of capital goods, and we're going to have economic progress, and a growing ability to produce in general. What will be the effect on the ability to produce minerals? There'll be an increased ability to produce minerals. And if we have any substantial increased ability to produce, and this is going on continually, then what will be the effect on the quantity of gold? That should increase too. And then if we have more gold, what should be the effect on the total volume of spending? That would increase. Ultimately, national income in terms of money would be higher. It would be higher as a result of what? Of the increase in the quantity of money, which was a byproduct of the increase in the ability to produce. But if we analyze things in the context of an invariable money, putting aside the increase in the quantity of money, the relationship between national income and progress and prosperity is inverse. Let me quickly cash in on this in one or two respects. Those of you who have the misfortune to have to read the contemporary economics textbooks are exposed to the multiplier doctrine, which you have a good quotation from Samuelson on. And then there is a peculiar variant of the multiplier doctrine called the balanced budget multiplier. The straight-out multiplier says if we do anything which increases spending anywhere, there'll be a multiplied further increase through more consumption. All right, that's a doctrine I consider sheer nonsense. If it applied, let's imagine for the moment that it were correct. Imagine that the kind of analysis Samuelson presented in the passage I quote, imagine that that applied, and we start out, we have some additional consumption, and then we get a multiplied increase. What would be the effect of that in an economy with an invariable money? Let's imagine here we are, we begin, we have 400 of national income, 1,000 of sales revenue, 600 of demand for capital goods, and now something will happen that will raise consumption from 400 to 600. Capital goods would fall. If the multiplier worked in this context, the significance would be disaster. We'd have a higher national income, but an absolute disaster. Now, the doctrine I want to give a little bit of attention to is this so-called balanced budget multiplier. The Keynesians start out by arguing that if we increase government spending through and finance it by a deficit, there's this wonderful magic of the multiplier. We'll raise national income by 2, 3, 4, or 10 times the deficit, whatever the multiplier happens to be. That's their straight-out multiplier. Then they devise, they have a negative multiplier for taxes. They say, by every dollar that we increase taxes, there's a negative multiplier. And they argue that the tax multiplier is a little bit smaller than the government spending multiplier. If the government were generous enough to raise our taxes and spend all of the tax increase, the Keynesians conclude it would raise the national income by an amount equal to the higher taxes and spending. If the government taxed us $10 billion more and was kind enough to spend the $10 billion, the Keynesians argue that national income would rise $10 billion. And this they call the balanced budget multiplier. You can look this up in the index of practically any economics textbook. Increase our taxes $10 billion, increase government spending $10 billion, we increase national income $10 billion. And they're so happy with this, they think government spending is wonderful even when we don't have a deficit, just if we have more. I'm going to get to it and show that it is. Now, in what sense it is. Now, on this, they also build what they call the conservative's dilemma. They say, here are the poor conservatives. They have two cherished values. They want balanced budgets and small government. They want balanced budgets with a low level of government. Yet, if they have balanced budgets, They can't have the wonderful stimulus of the full multiplier. And then to get the same stimulus, they need a much bigger increase in the government. You see, if the straight out multiplier is 4, then if you have a $2.5 billion deficit, you get a $10 billion expansion in the economy. But if the conservatives are in power and they don't want a deficit, then to get a $10 billion expansion in the economy, we have to have the government spend and tax $10 billion more. So the conservatives have this dilemma. They could have a modest deficit and have a relatively large expansion, or they need a much bigger increase in the absolute size of the government with a balanced budget. Now, and the Keynesians think, boy, they've scored on this one. Well, this is nonsense. It is true, it could be true, that when the government raises taxes by $10 billion and spends the $10 billion, it very well might be the case that national income could rise by $10 billion. If that $10 billion of taxes was paid with money that otherwise would have been used to buy capital goods, well, what's happened to the spending for capital goods? That's down by $10 billion. The government is spending the $10 billion. Total sales revenues in the economy are the same, but the cost on account of capital goods is less. So national income rises by the amount of the extra taxes and spending. Great. What is the significance of the rise in the national income? It's against progress and prosperity. See, the Keynesians have no idea of the real significance of the rise in national income. They're unaware of the fact that in the framework of an invariable money, it is inversely related to prosperity. All right, before we exit this point, I have developed these issues in tables 2 and 3, and I'd like you to briefly look over these tables because they'll serve as a springboard for the next stage of analysis when we get to profits. And notice what I'm doing here. We have in table 2 up on top, we have demand for capital goods and demand for consumers' goods. And I've drawn little lines down from under the 500 representing each of them, and then a cross and with an arrow going up. And those two expenditures represent the source of total sales revenues. There's 500 of spending for consumer goods, 500 for capital goods. The two together represent total sales revenues. And then in the next year, the 500 of spending for capital goods becomes the cost on account of capital goods of the next year. And that's how we get the national income of the next year. I want you to become familiar with this process of we have the spending of a current period generating the sales revenues of the current period, and some of the spending of the current period showing up as costs in the next period. And this is how we derive national income year by year. And the same procedure in Table 2 shows that it's 400 rather than 500. OK, well, now I'll be very happy to take any questions you may have. The gentleman in the back.
Yeah, I have difficulty with your figures there. $14,000 for the bread, the total product.
For the total product, yeah.
If one company or individual produced the wheat, the flour, and the bread,
yeah.
When they sold it, they only get a maximum of $6,000. Where did the other $8,000 come from?
From the fact that one company did not produce everything. If one company grew the wheat, made the flour and the bread and sold the bread, then the only spending would be $6,000. But what would happen when there is no spending to buy the flour and the wheat cannot be taken as the standard for what happens when there is the spending. You see, you cannot, here we are, we're discussing what is the spending? And you're telling me, no, that is not the spending, because if it weren't there, it wouldn't be there. But it's there.
My mistake, I thought you said that
That is the sales value. That is the sales value. We are looking at the total spending. Now, if we're looking at the total product, I would say the total physical product, whether it's owned by one company or several, it is still the wheat, the flour, and the bread. We're looking at the actual situation where we have different companies. You see, if the whole economic system were owned by one firm, you wouldn't have a demand for capital goods. It's only when there are separate firms that we have a separate demand for capital goods. And what we're looking at is separate firms. Yes?
On figure two, why do you have 1.2 pair of capital goods plus one pair of labor comes to 2.4 and not 2.2 or 2.6?
Why do I have it come to 2.4? Because I'm assuming that output is proportional to the supply of capital goods. So that if we have 1K, we could produce 2 units of wealth in either in the form of consumer goods or capital goods or any intermediate combination. If we have 1.2K of capital goods rather than 1, then we can produce 20% more. 2.4 is 20% more. We could choose a different one. You could ask, why do I assume that with each unit K of capital goods, we can produce 2 units of output? Because that is the simplest number to work with. You see, we have enough difficulties keeping track of everything, so when it comes to quantitative relationships, the principle is apply the simplest ones first. If we want to use percents, my favorite percent is 10%. Well, with integers, my favorite integer is 2. I think it's objective in the sense of wanting to minimize the work that one has to do. See, nothing depends on the particular number. We could take a random number of 8 digits to the right of the decimal, and it would all still be true. But we have enough to do to keep track of the basic relations. Ida.
With my ignorance, but I wasn't sure that you answered the first question. Namely, suppose a farmer produced the wheat himself, and then he became a miller or whatever, and he turned it into flour, and he was a baker.
Yeah.
How much money would you spend?
In that case, if the only thing that is sold for $6,000, then $6,000. Well, you see, then we have an infinite regress. We could say that we have to cut it off somewhere. I've used wheat, flour, and bread enough for many people. But, now, in reality, we could trace things back indefinitely. There's the seed, then the seed manufacturer, there's fertilizer. There's production behind that. If you really think about it, each good has a history that can be traced back to the first caveman. Because everything that is made with any kind of tool or material, it goes back to further tools and materials until you reach the point where the first caveman picked up the first rock. And we have to cut it off somewhere. But let me point out, the fact that production might go on with vertical integration. Well, that's true, but that does not mean that when it doesn't go on with vertical integration, the spending that occurs is then obliterated. That spending is there. I mean, we could raise questions, what if I hadn't been born? Now, I don't know what implications you might draw from that. Then you might say, I'd wear a much smaller shirt. But that, it's a totally illegitimate procedure when we want to analyze a something to try to analyze it on the basis of the obliteration of its existence. Yes?
Is it a reasonable way to think about it that the reason you want to think of these as the wheat and flour
Well, we want to, I'm not quite sure I grasp what you have in mind. Can you say it again? Yes.
And you ignore all the
capital. Right. If we don't take into account the purchase of the wheat and the flour and just look at the purchase of the bread, then we are omitting the major part of economic activity. We have no sound basis for carrying out economic analysis. You see, macroeconomics is supposed to be the study of the economic system as a whole. And the major part of economic activity consists of producing various types of capital goods, and most of the spending that takes place in the economy is at the level of capital goods and wholesale and so forth. And if we think we've got it all in the consumer goods, we're not looking at the subject matter we should be looking at, and then we're not able to see the kinds of things I developed last fall and presented to you today. And you end up with all kinds of errors, like thinking about the glories of national income, not being able to understand what capital accumulation depends on, thinking free immigration is a danger, not understanding why Soviet Russia, no matter what degree they concentrate on capital goods, can't maintain capital goods. Everything depends on being able to see reality as it fundamentally is. And to believe that the consumer goods capture everything is to be blind to reality. Mr. Karp.
What's a realistic number for the maintenance proportion in an economy like ours?
What is the realistic number for the maintenance proportion? I don't think I could confidently give you a number.
90%, 50%,
20%? I think it would be quite far above 50%. Quite far above. Dr. Locke? Yeah, in the context of an invariable money.
Okay. And how would the greater prosperity manifest itself for an individual if their income is lower? Is it through lower costs, lower prices?
Yes, let's consider that. You can understand that in terms of... Oh, I'm sorry, thank you. The question is, if national income did stay constant, how would prosperity manifest itself from the perspective of an individual? Well, if you turn to figure 2, we can answer that question, I think. Here we are in figure 2. National income is 400 instead of 500. All right, what is happening to prices every year in figure 2, to the prices of consumer goods? Yeah, every year 400 is spent to buy consumer goods, but each year there's 20% more consumer goods. So there's 400 of national income that buys 0.8C in year 2, then it buys 0.96, and then 1.152. So what's happening to the buying power of everybody's income? It's going up. Now, there would be people who have lower amounts of income, but what very soon happens to the buying power of the lower amounts compared with the greater amounts? It goes up. I would rather live in figure 2 with a lower money income of constantly higher buying power than in figure 1. I think Dr. Binswanger had a question.
I'm going to ask the question. It's probably an obvious fallacy.
All right.
When you spend more on capital, but this is for the lower national income, this
yeah. All right, well, you see, that is, the question is, how come if we have more spending for capital goods, there's a reduction in national income? Doesn't all the spending for capital goods end up as income to somebody? Doesn't all the spending for goods end up as income? I think the fallacy is the idea that all the spending ends up as income. It is not all the spending that ends up as income. The counterpart of income is only the spending for consumer goods. The counterpart of income is only the spending for consumer goods. What's true is, when you buy consumer goods and you trace it back and back and back, you'll find that ultimately there's an equivalent amount of income. But when we look at everything together, in each year there's $1,000 of spending. And in each year, what are the costs on account of capital goods? 600 or 500, one or the other. So in each year, what is the income? It's 500 or 400. It's 500 or 400. All right, I think I have to draw a line here, and we'll continue on Saturday. Thank you.